This is Radio Equalshock with your host, Alex Smith.
In war, humans count the war dead, buildings and roads destroyed. But we are not alone on this planet. Plants and animals are also casualties of war. So is the atmosphere. We don't hear about that, except from a few voices like author and journalist Nicholas Kozlov. Nicholas spent years not just studying South America, but living there. With his doctorate in Latin American history from Oxford, we could call him Dr. Kozlov. He published on Hugo Chavez and oil politics in Latin America and the book Revolution, South America, and the Rise of the New Left. It's a story which continues with recent leftist wins in countries like Chile. But in 2014, Kozlov turned towards the Ukraine and the ancient environment of the Black and Azov Seas. He traveled there four times in recent years and just published a blog roundup called Climate Emergency and War. From New York City, Nicholas Kozlov, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, we last spoke on the program in 2010 about the South American perspective. It was about the Cancun climate talks, actually. Seems like a long time ago. And I knew you as an expert on South America, from the deep Amazon jungle to oil politics. Tell us how you turned towards the ecoregion around the Ukraine and revolutionary hopes there.
Well, I'm a very idealistic person. So when the Maidan Revolution took place in Ukraine in 2014, I was very focused on it. And then I made four trips to Ukraine in subsequent years, reporting on any number of issues, including the environment.
Talk to us about your 2016 book, Ukraine's Revolutionary Ghosts. How does that look now?
Well, I went to Ukraine. I went to Kyiv. I interviewed many of the original youthful participants of the Maidan Revolution who were very concerned about that the Maidan Revolution would be squandered and that the social agenda would be ignored. And so it was a very idealistic take on the original youthful Maidan Revolution. And I also addressed such issues as ethnic minorities, anti-Semitism, the fight against oligarchical rule and whatnot. But as you mentioned, some of these issues in the context of the current conflict look a little bit quaint, I would have to say.
Well, people in Europe and especially in America immediately want to believe Ukraine wants to be just like us. They want to join the pool of super capitalist banks and get all the Western military weapons. Is that what Ukraine wanted in 2014? And is it what Ukrainians want now? What do you think?
Well, I've been in slight contact with some of my original contacts. Obviously, it's been a little more limited because people are just dealing with day-to-day survival. But my sense going back a few years was that there was a bit of ambivalence about NATO. But I think that perhaps now, in the context of war, perhaps those pro-Western sentiments may be strengthened, perhaps even on the amongst the original participants of the Maidan Revolution, the progressive left, etc.
Well, let's get away from the merely human. Talk to us about the environmental treasures at risk around the Ukraine region. Maybe we could start with that branch of the ocean that so few people in the West know about, the Sea of Azov.
Well, I was concerned about this environmental situation going back as far as 2014, and I wrote an article at that time in the aftermath of Putin's annexation of Crimea, which had obviously political consequences, but also economic consequences because there's just a tremendous amount of offshore oil and gas development in the Black and Azov Seas. And so I'm sure that Putin was motivated by diplomatic and political concerns in annexing Crimea, but in the process, there were some economic benefits because Russia absorbed a lot of that offshore oil development, but to the detriment of the environment and local wildlife.
Right. So there's a whole Russian fleet out in the Black Sea right now. So I presume that they control the oil and gas fields there. Are there actually developments there? Are the drilling platforms up in the seas, or is it a future thing?
Yeah, there is offshore oil and gas. And my concern is that not bringing this issue up to the present, There's been fighting in the Black Sea Biosphere Reserve, which is a UNESCO protected area, and the fighting, the explosions can be viewed from space. So I'm actually very concerned about this. And so in hindsight, I think my article from 2014 and my concerns on this front, unfortunately, they look a little bit prophetic. And I'm a little concerned about marine wildlife, for example, the Black Sea dolphin and sturgeon, which has been on the verge of extinction. And even before this conflict emerged, you had a lot of oil and gas contamination. And going back as far as 2007, I believe, there was an oil tanker which just broke apart in some freak storm in the Kerch Strait, which connects the Sea of Azov to the Black Sea. And a lot of local bird and wildlife was damaged by that spill. So this is actually an issue which predates this military conflict, but I think it could be exacerbated by the war.
Yeah, I could see a whole environmental movement to save the Black Sea. And both of those seas had decent fisheries for a very long time, but I've heard that that's on the edge and maybe overfished or polluted out of existence. And then you have all the wild birds that use the marshes along those seas. They're in danger. It sounds like a whole part of nature could be endangered by our human craziness, really.
Yeah, and you have such species as whale. It's a species of bird which was recklessly endangered by this spill that I mentioned going back as far as 2007. And so they were damaged by this oil spill, and they were on the beach and attacked by wild dogs. And so that was a key case of local wildlife being jeopardized by the oil industry in the area. And you're right. I think prior to oil development, reportedly, the local inhabitants in the Sea of Azov would go fishing. You have these Cossack communities, and the quality of the water was adequate, if not high quality. And that's been obviously jeopardized by the oil industry.
Well, let's get to the land of the Ukraine. When missiles ignite big oil and chemical tanks, the TV cameras lap it up. It's exciting video, and it's a sign of somebody winning and somebody losing, they claim. But, you know, for climate-aware people, those gas and oil strikes are a double disaster. We see even more carbon dioxide heading into the atmosphere to bring the storms and fires and weather extremes. Nicholas, what are your thoughts about the climate impacts of yet another war?
Well, I think if anything, this conflict has demonstrated that many of our forms of energy are quite antiquated, and that's certainly obvious when you have the Russians shelling an oil reservoir or a gas pipeline, or you have elevated levels of radioactivity emanating from Chernobyl or the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. And so I think the conflict has highlighted these concerns about our antiquated forms of energy use. I wrote the article because I'm quite an idealistic person. So even though this is a horrific conflict, I would like to find the silver lining. And if it takes a crisis for Europe and the wider world to move towards renewables, then I don't want to say that that's desirable, but under the circumstances, maybe there is some silver lining in this crisis.
Yeah, a bit of a bright side. You know, one other thing before we leave energy in the land is the coal mining. Something I didn't really think about until I read your article is Ukraine has been long known for massive coal mining, and now the soldiers are digging trenches and missiles are blowing craters up all around that. When the mining stops, perhaps because of the war, is coal passive or is it toxic?
I'm not entirely sure of that, but I do have some concerns about Europe reviving coal production, because this is going to be a huge issue. Because if Europe ceases to purchase Russian gas, then what are you replacing that with? And there's been talk about Poland, for example, turning towards coal. So I think probably in the best case scenario, this war will hasten Europe's and perhaps the rest of the world's turn towards renewables. But in the process of trying to replace Russian gas what are you replacing it with? Are you replacing it with coal? Are you replacing it with liquid natural gas, which has a higher carbon footprint than regular gas or nuclear? So I have these concerns that even as many European countries talk about transitioning towards green energy, in order to make up the shortfall from Russian gas, they might have to turn towards other forms of energy use, which could cancel out that turn towards renewable energy.
You know, the Ukraine's leading climate scientist, Svetlana Krakowska, was working to finalize a report for the IPCC when bombs started falling around her. And she immediately said, this is a fossil fuel war. How would you interpret that, Nicholas?
Yeah, I would definitely say that, since Russia finances its weapons through the sale of oil, gas, and fossil fuels. So I absolutely agree with that connection that she's making.
Yeah, but, you know, so is the American military. The biggest single institutional polluter of the atmosphere is the U.S. military. So when you see all the planes heading over to Europe with arms and troops scurrying around doing exercises, whether they're at war or not, it all adds to fossil fuels, and it really doesn't benefit anybody as far as I can see.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. It's also true that the United States has put up sanctioned Russian gas, but then in the process, Biden is tapping the nation's strategic oil reserve. And so this seems to be answering more towards maybe keeping gas prices low, protecting the Democrats in advance of the midterm elections, because consumers are angry about the high price of gas at the pump. But it really is quite a contrast to Biden's pledges in the 2020 election on climate change. And so you get these very strange, contorted reactions to this crisis. On the one hand, In the best of all possible worlds, I suppose it could hasten the turn towards renewable energy. But in the short term, I also see some counterproductive moves as well.
Yeah, the American energy lobby is flooding U.S. TV with advertising reminding everyone it's patriotic to push for more fossil fuel production to save the free world. And meanwhile, UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres just said fossil fuels are weapons of mass destruction. So contortion is the right word that you just used. How do you see this reframing of oil and gas in a time of war?
I think, again, in the best of all possible worlds, you know, you hear about Germany, for example, which is was reluctant to break with Russian gas imports, and they're going to they're going to cease the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which I agree with. But I guess the question is, will it be enough? And I don't minimize the practical challenges of transitioning towards this new green energy. And so I guess the question is, will solar and wind be enough with the Paris Climate Accord basically on life support? And so Bill McKibben, for example, has talked about this massive investment in heat pumps, electrical heat pumps, which transfer energy as opposed to supplying it. So what he's calling for is this massive ramping up of electrical heat pumps. Whether that's going to be enough to make up for this shortfall in the gas supply from Russia, I don't really know. But I guess my attitude at this point is whatever it takes to wake people up to this climate emergency. And so however horrific this conflict might be, perhaps this is just the necessary push that people need. Because I was very discouraged during COVID. I thought that was another opportunity to address the climate emergency. And emissions plunged in 2020, and then they shot up in 2021. So I thought that was a missed opportunity. So maybe, if anything, there might be a slight silver lining this time.
You published a revolutionary handbook about how to bring about nonviolent revolutionary change. If we defund fossil fuels and we go with localized renewable resources, that seems revolutionary to the people currently making a lot of money and in charge. Do you think big government knows that and they fear that transition?
Well, I'm not entirely convinced of that in the United States. I think if you judge them by their words, officials in the EU seem a little more on top of just how dire the situation is and how much the Paris Climate Accord is really on life support at this point. And they seem to also recognize that there are these contradictions. In other words, if you turn towards LNG or liquid natural gas, then, and if, again, if that has a higher carbon footprint than regular gas, then that could negate all these other renewables. And so I think the real question is, pragmatically, how do you move towards net zero? And so maybe it's just going to be a total, it has to be a climate mobilization at the scale of the Marshall Plan. And so I don't know if there's a political will to do that, but again, I'm an idealistic person, so hopefully there will be a slight silver lining in this conflict, and so we can start to get the ball rolling, which was not taken advantage of during the COVID emergency. And I think what's also discouraging is that COVID demonstrated that people can change their personal behavior. And so I think that COVID demonstrated that in a pandemic, people are capable of doing that. And so I would like to see the same commitment when it comes to climate. And I don't really see that right now in the United States, but perhaps in Europe, things seem to be moving in the right direction.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
We are talking with Nicholas Kozloff from New York City. What do you think? Is nuclear power the answer to climate change? The U.S. has announced they're going to do more nuclear building. Even France said they were going to get out of it, and now they're back with, I think they're going to build 12 more reactors, they say. Well, what's your view on this?
Well, certainly from the climate perspective, nuclear power is much more desirable than other forms of fossil fuel extraction. But obviously, nuclear power comes with a host of other problems. And then, needless to say, as we've seen in this military conflict in Ukraine, there have been elevated levels of radiation from the Chernobyl plants, which in turn experienced a dire accident in 1986. And the fallout from that is still apparent in Ukraine as well as Belarus. And so I think maybe the military conflict in Ukraine has highlighted concerns over nuclear power, because in the best of circumstances, nuclear power plants should run safely. But in the middle of a military conflict, all bets are off, obviously. So I have quite a few concerns about nuclear power, although I can see in some ways it might be in some ways attractive because it has lower emissions, but I don't think that's ultimately the solution we should be looking for.
Well, for me, I think nuclear technology has always been and always will be deeply entwined with nuclear weapons making, and nuclear weapons had been the major possibility of human extinction up until the climate crisis arrived. So for me, I am definitely against that as a solution. But you've been writing about social change. We are again seeing another hope of that in South America. Do you think there's any hope of avoiding a future of continuing climate disasters without a revolution in human social organization in every country, including America and Europe?
Oh, gosh. It's a huge question. I would say, just getting back to COVID, I was encouraged just to move this from maybe an abstract to a personal level. I was pretty encouraged in the beginning of, I don't want to say encouraged because the pandemic was obviously horrific, but, I live here in Brooklyn and you saw far fewer motorists on the streets, and it seemed like we had a bit of a respite from the climate emergency. And then it just seemed like then everyone just got back on the road. We've had just unbelievable amounts of traffic in the neighborhood, and the cops are just not really enforcing the law, and you have motorists thumbing their nose at pedestrians, and it didn't really seem to me like we took advantage of that moment to bring greater awareness to climate change issues. So I just getting back to what I was saying before, however horrific this crisis might be, maybe we won't miss the next opportunity to address climate change through this Russian gas, because of concerns over Russian gas. Perhaps we will take advantage of this situation and not kick the can down the road as we did during COVID.
Desmond Tutu said, "I'm not an optimist, I'm a prisoner of hope." And that seems to be what I'm hearing from you. I mean, there are times when I feel like I should just give up. The Amazon rainforest seems as doomed as the Greenland glaciers. I feel like maybe I should just quit and spend my remaining days on the best beach I can find. How are you holding up?
Well, throughout the pandemic, I was writing about, because I just, not to sound pedantic about this, but I am a very idealistic person. So throughout the pandemic, I was writing about, okay, well, how can we find the silver linings in this situation to address climate change? And for example, you had all these concerns about the meat industry and health and safety and during COVID because workers were falling ill. And so I wrote a number of articles essentially arguing that, well, however horrific the situation might be, again, perhaps this might be an opportunity to address supply chain issues and health and nutrition and start moving away from meat-based diet, which is also affecting the planet. And so I think perhaps there was a greater awareness around health and safety during the pandemic. And so that's another area that I was hoping that we could take advantage of that to reorganize supply chains, because agriculture and the food supply chain also accounts for a great degree of our climate change problems. And I'm not sure that's going to happen, but you do have, for example, these vertical farms. You have a great movement in the cities towards self-sufficiency. And here in New York, you have Mayor Eric Adams. I'm not saying that I agree with Eric Adams on every political issue, but he's been pushing this issue of food justice, food self-sufficiency, vertical farms. So perhaps there were some glimmerings or movement towards addressing climate change through food justice during the pandemic. And so maybe that's what people need. They need a bit of a push because normally, unless there's a crisis, unfortunately, people are slow to respond.
As we wrap up here, what are you working on these days? Do you have a new book in mind, or do you have a subject that you're following intensely?
Well, it's interesting you should mention that. I have any number of articles planned about Ukraine, but I was also planning to go back to South America to retrace Darwin's voyage, which, as you know, proved instrumental in the development of the theory of evolution. And so Darwin, observing wildlife in such places as the Galapagos, developed key ideas on evolution. But because of climate change, animals are having to adapt on a much heightened time scale. So I was hoping to make my way back to South America and to retrace Darwin's voyage, but this time to see how wildlife is adapting on this accelerated time scale to climate change.
From New York City, we've been speaking with widely published author and journalist Nicholas Kozloff, and you can find more of his work at nicholaskozloff.com and find links for this interview at ecoshock.org. Nicholas, thank you for sharing your time with us.
All right. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.